Good morning and welcome to a new season of Atlantic Voice. I'm Angela Antle. Today on the show, a feature interview with Pauline Dakin. That's right, her voice will be very familiar to many CBC listeners, but the story of her childhood and young adulthood will really surprise you. It's a story she's kept secret until now. Pauline Dakin was for many years the host of this program, and she was the CBC's regional health reporter. But a couple of years ago, she left the CBC behind to write a book. It's called Run, Hide, Repeat, a memoir of a fugitive childhood.
Well, I discovered when I was a young adult the reason for some strange things that had happened when I was growing up, and I was told that we had been on the run. And specifically on the run from the mafia. So just as a little bit of backstory, when I was going on 11, my family went on vacation. I lived in North Vancouver, and we went on vacation to the prairies to visit my mom's family. My dad was also from there, but my parents are divorced. And we just never went home. I woke up one night because I couldn't sleep, and mom made me a cup of cocoa and said, okay, I have to tell you something. We're not going back. So that was the first time when I was in grade 7 going into grade 8 or had just started grade 8. It happened again. But this time my mother said, okay, you guys, I'm not doing that to you again, so I'm going to tell you we're leaving. You can't tell anybody. And, you know, my brother Ted and I had grown up in this, atmosphere of great secretiveness, and we weren't allowed to talk about where we were going or what we were doing.
That must have been so hard to deal with at that age.
Yeah, I have two daughters now. They're late teens and early 20s. And when I think about what it would have been like to move them at that age, I don't think there's a worse time of a girl's development that you would take them away from their peer group and support group.
So your family always moved in tandem with another couple. Tell me about them, the Sears.
The Sears, Stan and Sybil Sears. And they came into our lives. My dad was alcoholic, and when my mother decided to leave him, she started going to a group that was a support group for families of alcoholics. She met some people there who recognized that she was, you know, in some emotional distress about all of this, and they recommended that she go and see this fellow, Stan Sears, who was considered a great counselor for, you know, these kinds of situations. He was a United Church minister in North Vancouver and also a psychologist. And so off my mother went to see Stan, and within about 6 months, she went from feeling, she told me later, she had been feeling suicidal, to sort of picking up the pieces of life and moving on as a single parent. And Stan became a huge source of support for her. She respected him immensely. He was a very intellectual man. But I think he was also the first man that she had ever known who was gentle and respected her. You know, she was in some ways a scholar, and he respected that in her. Eventually, my mother ended up working for him briefly. She needed work after she'd left her marriage. And she ended up working for him as a secretary, and then after the counseling was over, they became friends with his wife, Sybil. And, you know, it later turned out that, you know, Sybil was also aware of this running and the story about running from the mafia. So they were the closest family friends we had, and when we would disappear, we disappeared with them. We were the people that... They were the people that we spent Christmas and Easter and birthdays and all of those family-oriented times with. And I would say Stan was really the closest thing I had to a dad.
It reads like a spy thriller, Polly. I had a PDF because the book hadn't arrived, and I read 10 chapters on my phone, and I do not read things on my phone.
Well, that's terrible.
But I couldn't put it down, and my husband was trying to sleep, and I kept saying, you've got to listen to this. but then you start to pick apart that narrative. It starts with your mom and Reverend Sears telling you why you were on the run. and the sort of psychological turmoil that started for you. How old were you when the story came out about the mafia?
I was 23. I was working as a journalist at the Telegraph Journal in St. John, New Brunswick. And my mother had decided she was going back to school. She'd been going to school part-time for a long time, and she was going to go to theological school in Halifax. And so she got in touch with me and said, okay, you've always had a lot of questions about what's gone on with our family, and now is the time. So she arranged for us to meet in a motel that is now no longer there. It's been bulldozed, called the Bluebird Motel in Sussex, New Brunswick. And when I walked into the motel, there was Stan. And so they sat down and told me this story. You know, a part of me, I was a journalist. I was a young journalist. But, you know, I knew how hard it is for things like anything, you know, with that kind of implications to be kept quiet or secret. So there was always a part of me that was going, oh, come on. Oh, come on. People would know. And, you know, so the story is that, yes, we were on the run from the mafia, but there was also kind of a shadowy anti-organized crime task force that had been struck by the Privy Council to look into the problems of organized crime in Canada, and that task force part of their work was providing coverage or protection for people like us who had somehow gotten caught up in all of this. And so, you know, part of what I was told is that you have somebody who follows you, and, you know, they will take a bullet for you if they need to. You can't tell anybody about this. That was, of course, always the proviso. Mm-hmm. You can't tell anybody about anything. But that there was somebody who was sort of with me and making sure that I was okay.
You couldn't even tell the police, right?
Oh, no, because, you know, sometimes the police are in the pocket of the mafia, right? So I was told. And so, you know, I have to say, having somebody protecting me, following me, was just as creepy as the idea of being, you know, chased by the mafia. So, you know, I lived with that for some time, and I just kept in my head thinking, this can't be true. But then, you know, I would consider the source. And, you know, I knew that honesty was the primary principle for my mother. I just knew she wouldn't ever lie to us. She, you know, she was somebody that I 100% trusted. And Stan had become that too. Both of them had always been there for me in every way. And so I thought, well, I guess I have to believe it. If they tell me this is true, as crazy as it is, I guess I have to believe it. Part of me always questioned. But as I got older, I just started to notice little things, little patterns that made me question. And I just, you know, I don't know what, I remember thinking, I don't know what's worse here, whether the story's true or whether it isn't true. To me, both things were devastating, because if it wasn't true, the people I had chosen to trust most in my life were no longer trustworthy.
Right.
So it was a very painful thing. But finally, I decided that I had to know for sure that I, you know, it was going on trust was increasingly difficult. And so,
and it was starting to affect your relationships, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was affecting my relationships. It was affecting my brother's relationship. You know, we both had marriages that failed, and all of this, I think, was a part of that. So I set up a sting. I just had to know, and I set up a sting. And what I did was so Stan, who was working with this sort of anti-organized crime task force, and at this point had gone inside, meaning he no longer lived in the world. He now lived in what was sort of a protective custody situation. And he would occasionally come out to see my mother, and it emerged through the story that they had fallen in love. And so one time when I knew he was in the area visiting her, I called her and I said, my house has been broken into. What do I do? And sure enough, she said, our friend is here. I'll call you right back. I'll talk to him and call you right back.
And she said that because there was always the belief that you were being bugged, right?
Right. She couldn't.
It was a very intricate.
Couldn't talk about any of this over the phone.
Yeah.
So I sat, maybe the most anxious 5 minutes of my life, and the phone rang a few minutes later, and it was Mom, and she said, yes, you have been broken into. The people responsible have been picked up and are being interrogated, and you are to come here now. So I was to go to where she was living. And so I hung up the phone, and I knew this meant it wasn't true. I'd faked it, and I thought of all the other times where various circumstances may have been used to sort of bolster this story, and the whole thing came crashing down, and it wasn't true.
Well, what I really appreciate about your story, Pauline, is that nothing is black and white. There's always a gray area. You were hoping at that moment for a definitive end to it, and that your mother would finally see that it was a lie, and you didn't get that.
No. Yeah, I thought, oh, if I can just prove this, then she'll, you know, realize and put an end to this. So I told her, and she was horrified. But she wasn't horrified about the truth. She was horrified that I had put people in risk by disbelieving the story. Mm-hmm. And what frightened her the most was that if I didn't believe, I was no longer going to take precautions that might protect me. And she said, there are things you don't know. There are things you don't know. It's true. And to my mother's dying day, she did believe this. And
why do you think that is?
Because she loved and trusted Stan. She felt that he had saved her life. Not just once, really. Mm-hmm. And because she had invested most of her adult life and the existences of her children in all of this story, if this story wasn't true, I think if there had been a way to definitively prove to her that this was not true, I think she would have fallen over and never gotten up. Because, you know, she would have... When she was dying, she said to me, she wanted to give me one last warning. I know you don't believe this is true, Pauline, but, and then, you know, I'm saying, nope, I'm not listening to this, Mom. I know what you're going to say. It's okay. And she looked at me and she said, you know, Pauline, if you believe that, if you really, really believe this isn't true, you must have just hated me. So she had insight to this in an interesting way. And of course I said, no, you know, I don't hate you. I've been really, really mad at you at times in the past, but I don't hate you.
This must have really been difficult to carry on a friendly relationship with your mom when there's so many levels of dishonesty.
Mm-hmm. It was. And eventually we just reached this place where we agreed to disagree. And you know, there were always times that I thought, okay, this will be the thing that helps her get past this. You know, when my dad died. And she, you know, my dad, she was afraid of him. He was an abusive man, and she was afraid of him. And I thought, well, maybe once that threat is gone, you know, she'll be able to take a step back. And that didn't happen.
Because he was painted as a part of this plot, right? He was one of the mafia leaders.
Yes. He was a kingpin in the Vancouver waterfront mafia, was the story. And then, of course, eventually Stan died. And I was sure that when I had gone, after I decided this wasn't true and I did my little sting operation and I satisfied myself that this wasn't true, I went to see a psychiatrist and I said, okay, tell me, what the heck is going on here? Why does somebody who clearly loves us and cares about us and doesn't appear, you know, in any other way to have a problem, like, what could explain this thing? Well, the guy was blown away. He was taking notes. I was quite sure he wanted to write this up in a journal, but he really didn't have anything helpful to say. He talked to me about something called folie à deux, which is, it's a condition where a more powerful person can have a delusion, and a less powerful person becomes caught up in that delusion and believes in it. And, you know, I could see how that would fit. My mother was in a very vulnerable condition when she met Stan. Mm-hmm. But, okay, that explains that bit, but it doesn't explain what's wrong with Stan and why would he do this. Other than, you know, is he psychotic? But, you know, typically people who are paranoid and psychotic and schizophrenic display a lot of other problems that make them easy to pick out.
And he wasn't a mean person.
No, no.
Or an abusive person. In fact, they were quite kind. Your mother and him did a lot for less privileged people. They worked as ministers. They were people's counselors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they had, I would say, a joint dream that was really what brought them together, is they were both incredibly idealistic people who wanted to make the world a better place.
Mm-hmm.
And they both could see the brokenness of the world and felt compelled to, you know, do something to help. So, yeah, in many ways, they did in many ways.
You were a medical journalist for many years at CBC, and I really appreciated the end of the book where you really do the detective work that's needed to get a clinical diagnosis, I guess, for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Why was that important?
Oh, because that had been the big question, you know, from the time I made this discovery and that it was all a hoax. Why would this happen? And it had, you know, such devastating effects on our family. And I, you know, was out of touch with most of my family for many years and, you know, lost touch with many friends. Why would somebody do that to you? And at one point, I guess I decided, you know what, I used to be like a little mouse in the wheel in my brain trying to figure that out. And there were no answers. So at some point I went, I'm not going to think about this anymore. I'm going to get on with my life. And I began to work at the CBC and I had a couple of kids and, you know, found a life. But a few years ago, I decided to go back to school and do a master's in fine arts in creative nonfiction. And I had a book all lined up that I wanted to write about kids and technology.
I was going to say, it wasn't this book.
No,
I bet,
it wasn't this book at that point. But it just seemed that maybe this was a great opportunity to try and sort all of this out in my head. And, you know, initially I did not think I would write this book for publication. I thought, you know, A, I needed to sort it out in my own head after trying to forget about it. I was just never really going to forget about it. And by this point, my mother had died. And I also felt that I needed some way to explain all of this to my kids at some point.
Mm.
It was pretty obvious to them that I had not had a normal childhood or family relationships. And I wanted them to know the story in a way that didn't make them hate my mother, because my kids are very protective of me. I wanted to be able to tell them this in a nuanced way so that they weren't judging and they were hopefully developing some empathy around the whole situation for my mom. As a result of doing the research that I was doing, I one day stumbled on a medical paper. I started reading it, and suddenly I realized this was the thing. I just knew in my heart that this was what was going to explain this to me. It was by a psychiatrist at Harvard, and it was about something called delusional disorder. And as I read, I just was so excited that this might be the explanation. And so when it happens, the people who suffer from it don't believe there's anything wrong with them. They don't go looking for help. So the delusion exists only within the person suffering from this disorder and the people they share it with. They otherwise appear completely normal. And quite often there's a later onset in life with this condition, and that means that people tend to be educated, they've got a career going, they
have a certain amount of status.
Yeah. So by the time Stan started to experience this, he was a minister, he'd studied psychology, he was married, he had two sons who were almost grown up. And so they look like they're, you know, a regular part of the community. And I guess, you know, their delusions are coherent. They may be weird, but they're possible. Mm-hmm. Maybe not probable, but possible. And they can defend them with really clear logic. And in Stan's case, I believe Stan was brilliant. And he was able to create an entire world with an entire cast of characters, which, by the way, included doubles, and keep all of this straight. And if you identified an inconsistency of any kind, there was immediately an explanation for that. So when I read this, I couldn't believe it. So I immediately called this guy at Harvard and said, can I talk to you? Can I ask you some questions? Can I tell you a story? And he was so excited to talk to me because it's rare that you get to hear these full stories. And also maybe more rare to hear the case of a delusion in somebody who is so intelligent and has such a well-formed delusion. And I think he had a secondary type, which is called grandiosity. And I see that in the fact that he believed he had this secret knowledge about this anti-organized crime task force, and they called it the weird world, in that, you know, there was this inside where people could either be grabbed and taken and imprisoned, or where you could go for protective custody. And so, but he was the conduit to this world because it was so secret. So that really fits with that piece as well. Anyway, I called this Theo Manstreck, and we were really excited to talk to each other. And he said, oh, yes. And he said, I think you're exactly right. Oh, my goodness, isn't this something? And then he said, you know, the guy who's really the world expert on this, I think he's somewhere in your neck of the woods. Dalhousie?
Down the road.
What are the odds of that? So, of course, I immediately looked up Alistair Munro, who's professor emeritus at Dalhousie, and we met and talked about this, and he agreed as well. And, you know, I have to say, finding that out was, it lifted a huge burden from me. I no longer had to be so angry. I didn't have to hate Stan for what he'd done to my family because he was sick. And he fully believed what the stuff he was making up. Mm. And it allowed me to forgive him and to, you know, remember more the person that I thought of as a father.
And you do get to forgiveness. And you actually went and spoke to Stan's sons, mm-hmm. right? One of his sons.
Yep.
Who confirmed that his father had been acting strangely from his point of view as well.
Yeah. So John is his name, and I went to visit him just over a year ago. And I told him this story, and he and his wife. And he looked at me, said, you know, I never knew if it was real until the moment you sat down and told me this, but I knew something was wrong. And he was just getting ready to get married and, you know, move out and be an adult when Stan started acting strangely. And, you know, began telling his family there's danger, there are people with guns, you know, strange things were happening for him. And, you know, he was completely, as you would be, blown away by the story. And interestingly, another good man, because he also apologized to me for what his dad had, you know, essentially done to my family. And he felt terrible about that. But it was a remarkable thing and he and I are still in touch. Mm-hmm. And he gave me permission to use our conversation in my book, and so it's in there. An incredibly generous guy.
Did writing this deeply personal and incredibly complex story, did it help you?
Yes. Oh, I feel as though I'm pounds lighter. Maybe not in reality, but emotionally.
I bet.
Yeah. It really has set me free. You know, you can imagine how something like this sort of makes you feel outside of things.
I can only imagine that because you did such an incredible job with the story.
It does. You know, it sets you apart. And always being told you can't tell and the secretiveness, I think, impaired my ability to be real with people in some ways. And I feel as though I am free now to be exactly who I am, and I have no secrets. And I can't tell you how much I love that feeling.
Mm. How did your daughters react when they read it?
Oh, it was quite a beautiful thing, really. Well, my older daughter read it. It wasn't fully written, but when she was 18, it was underway, and she read the first few chapters. And then I filled her in with the rest of the story. And her response was, she had so much empathy for me and for my mom. And so that made me feel that I had, you know, I was doing the right thing. Mm-hmm. That she had a very intelligent response to it, full of feeling for, you know, for all that had happened, but not judging my mom. That was the goal. And then my younger daughter, Laura, who's 18 now, she started to read the book, and she didn't finish it right away because she found it very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, you know, she had a very similar response. She and my mom were very close, and I think she found a lot of this very upsetting. And, you know, it led to some family conversations for sure.
Congratulations. It's an amazing story.
Thank you very much, Angela. It's great to talk to you.
That was Pauline Dagan, the former host of Atlantic Voice, now the author of an incredible book called Run, Hide, Repeat, A Memoir of a Fugitive Childhood. That's all the time we have for today. I'm Angela Antle, the host and producer of Atlantic Voice, our region's long-form storytelling show. Stuart Young is our executive producer. Join our Facebook group to hear more about our documentaries and feature interviews. And we're on iTunes as a podcast. Thanks for listening.